The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
How can you not love a poetry reading that gets started with talking heads coming over? That was just too cool. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming to our annual Newer Poets event. This is exciting. I would just like to take a moment to ask previous Newer Poets to stand up and be recognized. Several of them are in the room. Come on up. Get your bad selves up there. Turn the mic. I've got a voice like an air raid siren. They can hear me without it. Okay. Fred wants me to turn this toward me. Can you hear me? Okay. All right. Anyway, this is a very exciting reading series. We've been doing it for many years now. And basically, six poets are selected with the help of the Los Angeles Poetry Festival, run by Suzanne Lummis, and Beyond Baroque, directed by Fred Dewey. And we consult other entities as well when we select the poets for the year. We speak with poetry teachers such as Laurel Ann Bogan, who's somewhere in this audience. Yeah, there's Laurel. Where are you? Oh, you moved. You moved. Okay. And we also consult groups like the World Stage, people like G. Murray Thomas, people who have been involved with the community a long time, so that we can bring forth exciting voices and have them be recognized. This is our way of saying, city, these are your poets. And so to start off, and now I haven't even told the Beyond Baroque poets which order they're going in. So, folks, it's going to be like this. Brooke, Mark, Mindy on our end. So let me speak to you now of Brooke Sproul. Brooke, what?
Can you put Brooke towards the end? Sorry. Can you follow the clock? We talked right before.
And nobody talked to me.
Well, I thought we were following the order. Anyway.
When are we invading Iran? Are you going to tell me? Okay. All right. Anyway. All right. So who's going first?
Mark.
Okay, well, I shall speak to you now of Jean-Marc Beaver. Mark Beaver has studied poetry with Steve Cowett and Sandra Alcocer at San Diego State University, Mary DeLeva at San Francisco State University, and he's been a member of Laurel Ann Bogan's poetry group, her class, since 2002. Performances of his poetry have been staged by Oakland's Augustino Dance Theater, and his poetry has been published in the college text, Active Voices 4, San Francisco's Tea Party magazine, and in the LA Poetry Festival T-Bot Box Online Quarterly, Speechless. We asked him late last year, that was his Christmas gift, we told him he was going to be a Newer Poet. We're delighted to bring him to you, so please welcome J. Mark Beaver.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to everybody who came out tonight. And I've got a few thanks as well. I want to thank my partner of 16 years, Augusto Ferials, for being my first draft manager. I want to thank my family for having come up from San Diego today to see this. LA Poetry Festival, Beyond Baroque, Suzanne Lummis for having been an early booster, and my great friend and poet Claudia Handler, and of course the amazing Laurel Ann Bogan. Now I will read some poetry. This is a fairly early piece that I brought I think this is one of the first things I worked on in Laurel's group. It's called Instructions Regarding the Obvious for My Urban Nieces and Nephews. One, there is a forest of trees in the city. Look for a tree here in this constricted knot of roads, maybe a ficus benjamina bound within a tight square of stone, healthy and huge. Smell for the herbed scent of its breath in the mornings or at sundown after an oppressively hot day. Look deeply into the green and sheen of its leaves. Two, listen. There are mockingbirds in the trees. You can hear them mimic car alarms and the ring of cellular phones. See them. Flocks of feral parakeets flash their panavision over the strip malls, and crows as large as dogs feeding on the shoulders of the highway, their beaks blacker than spinning wet tires. Three, take yourself to the edge of the downtown high rises and weave the evening light through the gaps in the buildings. There are angles through which you can watch a slim strip of the sun setting over the distant coast. Four, seek the longest view. It may be out across the highway and then through the park. Let your sight travel. Find the farthest person you can see standing or walking. They will be too far away to notice your gaze. Watch them. See if they stretch themselves or run in place. Watch to see if they stand impatiently or if they are in company of friends or if they seem to be glad to be heading wherever they are headed. See how easily they hold their bodies when they feel they are unseen. Like the trees and the birds, they are thriving. All of them marked of the city, no longer exiled from field or forest, but filled through with the movement, dust, and thrum of this living engine. This piece is called Living Will. Still an ungainly teen in a small town chemistry class, my mother splashed a single drop of hydrochloric acid against her cheek. It burned, and she washed it, and a tiny mole replaced the burn. I have a tiny mole in the same place, a burn that penetrated a generation. The tiniest of ancestral mutations that I could continue to pass along with the damaged root of a thumbnail, the dog bite scar over my left eye, the tendency towards osteochondroma of the right femur. I would do it gladly. Gather all the physical scars of a dozen generations and pass them along in trade against all the unseen deformities, the withered spirits, the hungers and their invisible empty bottles, green and brown and amber with their childproof caps, the calluses on the heart that bitter words and pinch the eyes into slits. I would will all the weakness of bone, all the pox and bruises and burns onto one of my own in exchange for one strong and scarless heart, one flawed and open face. Thank you. This is my newest poem. Jury's out as to whether it's done, but it's called Dodo for Anne Sexton. Under white moons, strapped tight against night's black leather, pierced through with the terror of stars, the dodo steps warily from the jungle of her dusty and plasticine diorama. Her asylum has spread out across continents, sightings from remote corners, electricity humming off the telegraph. From corroded speakers, the narrator's static. Notice how the thin legs, the delicate feet, balance the bulk of the canvas-covered torso, the bulk of restraints and buckles, the crest of feathers like hair sparking forgetfulness. She is shown emerging from her nest, little more than a hollow, worried into the ground, defenseless. Her eyes roll chameleonic, see every direction at once. One fixed behind her on the flat tempera depiction of her native landscape, the other set on the horizon, the plate glass, the academic museum, the explanations and contexts, maps of her territory dwindling over time. What we won't see is the movement, the tortured struggle of flightless wings. What we don't hear are the cries that can only be guessed at, the mating calls she turned in circles around the last lover she had left, the alkaline scent like crushed insect on the tongue, the glorious ferment of death's sweet and overripe fruit. Thank you. Lighten the mood a little. I was a Navy brat, and I lived a lot of places. The high school I graduated from was my 12th school. And for a couple, for about a year, we lived in a wonderland called Guam. And this poem is a tribute to Guam of sorts. It's called Guam is a four-letter word. Guam is a four-letter word. If the air had not been so wet, heavy and hot, stewing us bitter like tea bags in a massive coral cup, if there hadn't been so many bugs, no tiny jewels of nuisance, but winged, palm-sized, and scrabbling blisters of disgust, and shrews, lizards, and wasps. If the poisonous fish, turkey, and lion, and rockfish hadn't been waiting just off Gabo Gabo Beach to squish out from beneath our required and sodden sneakers. If the toads, like gangrenous and abandoned feet, hadn't slapped their way across the softening asphalt to gather in the middle of the night, I was sure, at the prehistoric stone altars hidden everywhere, even engulfed by the trunks of gargantuan banyans. Then the typhoons, the tropical depressions, the battered and broken acres of banana, all of anything green growing or rotting as we watched, slime of moss on the windows, the sidewalks, along the sides of the roads, and over the tunics of shattered cemetery angels, rust staining their stumps where their wings had been bombed away. If only the island didn't shake every day, trembling on her three skinny legs as the crown of thorn starfish chomped at her knees. Maybe if we hadn't felt so pale and alone out on the endless cocoa sea, we might have stayed a while, set up a five and dime in downtown Agana, or settled into our own Quonset aesthetic deep in the swelter near Talafofo Falls, carved out our own muddy divot while teetering on the edge of the bottomless Marianas Trench, steaming and vast. I have no idea how we're doing with time. Does anybody? Okay, I'll do one more. This poem is just almost a year old. 2 days in Santa Barbara, age 45. For my 45th birthday, I drove alone from L.A. out through the suburbs that constrict against their life-giving 101. A fire had burned for most of the last month southeast of Goleta, and as I neared Ventura, a yellow anvil of smoke bruised the afternoon air. The coast was unmarred. Traffic slid along its shanks like seawater sheeting off any of the summer tourists, pulling themselves free of that cool salt below the road. I checked into a clean white beach motel and walked up the sand to the wharf and through the clockwork heart of the town that had become one of America's late century anytowns. The cobblestones led to the same stores they would have brought me to in Santa Monica or Santa Cruz. I bought my lunch from one of the many chains, and I took in a film at the town's oldest theater, which wore its crumbling fourplex pride like a shawl just about to slip from its bowed shoulders. Back in the motel room, restless as the last light gasped in the west, the faint scent of burnt sage on its breath, I poured a drink, took a shower, and settled for TV. I wanted to grab my pillow and blanket and drag them across the beach to the sand. I wanted to roam the night streets and stumble across some tavern run by the same family since 1962. I wanted to find a flavor, a sound, a curve of raw land still standing its ground. And I realized that even the angry and moaning sea was fast becoming something different, changing by committee. That many of the few things still discoverable were right now over those glowing hills, coming down in specks on my car, dotting the surface of the blue, blue motel pool. And as the morning's perfect newscasters announced in optimistic tones, over 50% contained. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Our next reader, Mindy Netafee. It's Mindy, right? We got this straight. It's Mindy. Okay. Two of the readers here tonight, two of our newer poets, helped me set a bonfire in my backyard 2 years ago on the hottest day on record. Do we remember. We ate a lot of ice cream that evening. And I'm just delighted that both of them are here tonight and that we don't have a bonfire. Mindy Netafee, a pushcart nominee, was born in Des Moines, Iowa, and raised pretty much by the Southern California poetry scene. Some of you may remember her as the cover gal on Next Magazine, as the face of the new generation of poets. And that was, only about 5 minutes ago. She was 15. She became the Long Beach Orange County Poetry Slam Grand Slam champion. That's not a meal item at Denny's. And subsequently, she competed on and coached teams at 5 national poetry slam competitions. And she's the author of 5 chapbooks, and her full-length collection, Sleepyhead Assassins, is available on Moontide Press. Her work has appeared in ISM Magazine and the California Poetry Anthology, and she has toured in poetry shows and festivals from Hawaii to Munich. She was recently chosen as one of the inaugural performers for the Best Contemporary American Poet Series. She's a total slacker, never gets anything done. She holds a bachelor's in social sciences from Chapman University, which means she's hung around the ugly mug. But the important thing is she moved into our county a couple of years ago, so now she's ours. Orange County can't have her anymore. She served on the 5 Penny Poets Advisory Board for T-Bot Bach. And not only that, we sacrificed her as a virgin to the flames 2 years ago. It was a night to remember. And after you've heard her read, you'll remember her too. Ladies and gentlemen, Mindy Netafee. Yay. Wow.
I feel about as newer tonight as I felt a virgin at that bonfire. Thank you, Amelie. I would like to thank definitely Amelie Frank and G. Murray Thomas for both being a part of bringing me here tonight. Let's see. Let's get started. This first piece I'm going to read, I actually just wrote at a writing retreat up in Ojai. It was 110 degrees this weekend in Ojai. It was kind of like a 72-hour sweat lodge. And this is what happened. It's called 1 mile per hour faster than the speed of light. Subtitle, Suck It, Einstein. They want us to believe it can't be done. Just imagining it makes their fuzzy, science-y heads hurt. Makes the formulas shudder like shotgun shacks. But I could imagine it all day. What happens after your mass has crushed in on itself? When your soul snuffs out beyond the reach of all light, past all the wizards and isms and faces like compasses calling you home, what's left of you? The most impossible parts. Just air vibrating around the thin waist of a string. Just the small gathering changes that tell a cloud to form. Your whole being concentrated on inventing new words to tell yourself stories with. New words for dark and now. And yes, sitting here blinking in the sun, sweating its light out with my soft chemistry, discovering life so slowly, the time-lapse photographs show only stillness. I have to believe there must be one ambitious photon who made it. One particle of light that remembered the secrets to charming barriers. One little wave who, in the opposite of a flash, found the other side and became the first to break free, the price of which is always never coming back. Let's see. I wrote this piece about a year ago during awards season, and it's called Acceptance Speech. I usually like keep it folded up in my brassiere and pull it out to read, but I can't think of it. Acceptance Speech. I would like to thank first my asthmatic lungs, my inadequacy in the bedroom, my dark Texas reckless streak and waning night vision that make awareness of my own mortality possible. Next, I would like to thank my constant nightmares for their vivid, arresting creativity, their cheerful execution of ritual disembowelment, their lifelike rendering of flesh-eating animatronic bunnies, and their resourcefulness in general with symbols for personal failure. I must next thank my inability to balance a checkbook, coupled with my whimsical attitude about money and my magically disappearing work ethic, without which my debt would be nothing. And while we're at it, thank you, Blockbuster Video, for ruining my credit with $17 in late fees from 1996. Next. A big thanks to my father, the pathological liar, who in his way taught me to be a poet. Thank you, sanity, for being a finite natural resource. To my crippling self-doubt, thanks. To my weak left eye My squishy arms, my smaller right breast, misshapen as a Tijuana coin purse. Thanks. Thank you, allergic rash. Thank you, pens, which run out of ink when I'm finally being brilliant. Thank you, humiliation, with a special shout out to Brad Carlson. You know what you did. Thank you to my guts. I love your red twistiness, your endless judgmental bullshit, your fleshy gears, your broken alarm bells that look like little French knots. I trusted you. Finally, I would like to thank you for sleeping with that other woman who was so much prettier than me. For a moment, you really had me going. Whipped cream puppies, slippery cloud sex, forever and ever and all that. There was so much sweet hope in my plastic farm heart. The ants were building sugar castles in my ventricles. There was so much dopamine sogging my brain. I thought we had invented flying. It's so much better here on the ground, where the morning light tastes like asphalt and swing set rust, where everything has teeth that glow, where I can afford large grains of salt with the money I save, buying into nothing. Thank you. This next poem is from my first full-length book called Sleepyhead Assassins. I write a lot about my family, those poor people. This one is called Seven Things I Never Told My Older Sister Because I Know Better. In reverse chronological order. Number one, if you ever feel like leaving him, renting a rich blue convertible and becoming someone else somewhere in the desert, I will go with you. Number two, thank you for all the horrible and or dangerous things you did first so I could learn from your mistakes, specifically getting herpes, dropping out of school, and getting a trendy dream catcher tattoo. Number three, I dropped acid with your ex-girlfriend. Number four, remember back during your chunky crystals and channeling spirits phase, when you told me in the back seat of a Ford Taurus that you had spoken with my higher self and she was really worried about me? I haven't trusted myself since. Number five, I took French in school because you did. And I thought we would be able to have top secret conversations about sex and drugs and rated R films in front of Mom. Why didn't we do that? Number six, I was the one that destroyed your Black Crowes tape, not the dog. Number seven, every time you ran away from home, I followed you. Thank you. While we're on fun stuff from my youth, this is called Fountains of Youth Revisited. Peeing in my snowsuit fountain. Bike gets stolen and now you're walking to school fountain. Armpit bee sting fountain. First time I called my mother the B-word fountain. Noxzema makes me break out fountain. won the dance-off, and now no one will talk to me, Fountain. I don't give a care, Fountain. Really bad short haircut the week before school starts, Fountain. It's called unrequited love. Get used to it, Fountain. Thank you. Let's see. This poem was came out in an anthology earlier this year called The Last American Valentine. It's a love poem that's kind of about one of those decades-long sexual tension marathons. It's called Your New Girlfriend Is Really Nice. You are an impossible birthday party. You are cloud climbing. You are muscle relaxant archery. I was never a straight shooter with you. So I'm telling you now why I got this strange bravery messing my chest. I love you like Mexican wrestlers love their outfits. I miss you like graffiti misses clarity. I want to crack open for you like a sinner on Sunday when I see you kiss another woman. My arm hairs form armies of Elliott Smiths, sifting the wind for some soft suicide song. You are the naughty punctuation mark I've always been looking for. You're the electric chair that completes my sentence. The starving wolverine in my mailbag of wholesome thoughts. I am afraid of regrets. In my dreams, they rise up like froth-mouthed horses, apocalypse black and freaking out. When I'm awake, I can trick myself into believing almost anything. It's not magic, it's serial optimism. But I'm not buying our someday. Your gravity is just moonshine. It's not the real dance of two heavenly bodies or even the bumping of two cake forks at the dessert table. I just wanted to let you know, I know. I just wanted to warn you. I'm signing up for vanishing lessons. If I ask you to meet me on a windy pier somewhere overlooking the sandy blue cache of the Pacific. If I ask you to wear your best wool coat, don't show. Thank you. I'm gonna read one more piece, and I don't know what it is. How about... this is appropriate. This is my love poem for all the male poets I know. It's called Untitled Because No Title Is Good Enough. If a man is only as good as his word, then I want to marry a man with a vocabulary like yours. The way you say dicey and delectable, an octogenarian in the same sentence. That really turns me on. The way you describe the oranges in your backyard using anarchistic and intimate in the same breath. I would follow the legato and staccato of your tongue wrapping around your diction until listening became more like dreaming. And dreaming became more like kissing you. I want to jump off the cliff of your voice into the suicide of your stream of consciousness. I want to visit the place in your heart where the wrong words die. I want to map it out with a dictionary and points of brilliant light till it looks more like a star chart than a strategy for communication. I want to see where your words are born. I want to find a pattern in their astrology. I want to memorize the script of your seductions. I want to live in the long-winded epics of your disappointments, in the haiku of your epiphanies. I want to know all the names you've given your desires. And I want to find my name among them, because there is nothing more wrecking sexy than the right word. I want to thank whoever told you there's no such thing as a synonym. I want to throw a party for the heartbreak that turns you into a poet. And if it's true that a man is only as good as his word, then sweet Jesus, let me be there the first time you are speechless and all your explosive wisdom becomes a burning ball of sun in your throat, and all you can bring yourself to utter is, "Oh God, oh God."
You know, you may notice that right before they do their last poem, the poets are looking at me and doing this. They're telling me to rack them up a Dos Equis. I suspect that our next poet will probably want a Pacifico. Before I bring up the third poet, I just wanted to acknowledge somebody. It might be Suzanne had planned to acknowledge him later, but we were talking about all the different people who have come through and entities that have come through with funding for this event. And I want to acknowledge Terry McCarty, who has personally contributed to the honoraria for our poets and for printing for this event. And Terry, thank you. Terry definitely puts his money where his mouth is when it comes to our community. Brooke Sproul has come to us from the world stage. Juwanza, you here? Is that you?
Yes.
I got lights in my eyes. I can't see. Okay, Juwanza's over there. He's the master behind all of it. The world stage is this amazing writing and performance space, and in Limerick Park, and which we honored at Beyond Baroque last year. And Juwanza is also himself a former New Air poet. And Juwanza spoke to me of Brooke and said that he wanted to see her become a New Air poet this year. And so she has been part of their workshop for the past 5 years and credits the world stage as her major poetic influence. And that's an incredible influence. True? Yeah, okay. Okay, how many Dos Equis over there? Okay. Let's see. She's been featured at the Beyond Baroque, at Beyond Baroque, and her work has appeared in the Voices from Limerick Park anthology, as well as Pearl magazine. She's currently working on her master's degree in social welfare at UCLA, and we're delighted to bring her up tonight. So please, a warm welcome for newer poet Brooke Sproul.
This is even lower than I expected it to be. Thank you so much for having me. I am honored, and I almost wish that I had gone first, because I feel that I'm so humbled and awed by the former poets, and your expectations might have been a little lower if I had gone first. And I have to thank Juwanza, even though Amelie did a beautiful job talking about the world stage. I have to thank Juwanza, and Dee Bryan is another featured reader tonight and a world stage poet as well. The first poem is called Ween. He is a cat tit. My sandpaper tongue is dry. On a hair and saliva diet, I lick my own breast. I slide you all my face cards, let you win, fight to be your gutted box, then cardboard cut out. I'm strong as Kevlar, crutches, stomach, strong as a tadpole, hanging between the monkey bars of the Serenity Prayer, looking for my legs. Thank you. I lived in Spain a few times, and this poem is called Sopelana. It's a beach in the Basque region in Spain. Sopelana. Wednesday afternoon, I Googled the cliff where we first kissed in Spain. I could see the wind, even in the still image, and the bluffs were empty. I dragged my mouse across the vacant city and her featureless buildings, scanning the landscape for feelings I left on Lendakari, Aguirre, Sarico, and Moyua, San Ignacio, the metro stop where you left without kissing me. I don't miss the hills of Guipúzcoa, where I learned the word green, or the forceful silabos castellanos and siseos punctuated with the aboriginal X's and K's of Euskara, each word a linguistic artifact in the excavation of sound. I don't miss the whitewashed houses of Getxo, green and red flags raised like Batasuna fists, salted bacalao hanging from windowsills in the houses of fishermen whose rowboats stud the water like earrings. Nor Iker mispronouncing my name, Estefania's too loud laugh, nor Sergio's descriptions of wine's dryness in La Rioja. Not Jonathan's love notes made of words like amanecer, Martin's deep voice always attempting to hide his grin, or the silver reflection of the Guggenheim's flowery edges in the Rio Nervión. How do I miss your red eyes when I left, my tears, and the pretense that you didn't care? Thank you. That's your cue to clap. I'm going to do a new one against Jawanza's advice, but with Brian's sanction, so I've got competing interests. This is untitled as of right now. The thorns fall from my stock, my green is naked, and the robust orange of my confidence hisses between wet fingers he didn't call. Shadows make dead rats of banana leaves. Hope twists me into gnarled antlers, strong and ugly. Uncertainty leaves me like metal in the jaws of life. I'll shrink back to my original dimensions now, where hope is a mouse, desire a newspaper, and I am quiet and don't love myself. Thank you. Before. At 8 years old, before I learned to be afraid, I kept daddy long legs for pets, let them crawl along my forearm, leaving goosebumps on my skin like cold. Caught crabs' claws puffed up like red brigandine, barnacled backs, toothed pinchers cupped between the breakable flesh of my bare hands. Grabbed a catfish from a bucket on the pier, its gills like pulsing machetes. Legs to chest, let caterpillars' orange suction cups inch across my kneecap's horizon, chin pressed to skyline, its mango eyes, undulating cold torso, nearly combed my lashes. I ran the underside of my fingers down black needles one by one. They scraped fine chalk lines in my skin. Pinched a brown anole by the rear, its tail dropped off, thrashed like a dying dragon or earthworm on a sidewalk after rain dries. I remember braille of wood frog skin, like jade roe, awakening my pores, thorax of wasps like obsidian beads I coveted flowers for, rattle of centipede as it billowed like a hissing flame in the empty Hartley's jar, a sentient maraca before I learned to be afraid. Thank you. I'll go with this one. Adam. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers will inherit the kingdom of God. 1 Corinthians. You are Canaan and pulp in exile. Acid and rind slide down my chin. We suck gold udders. You translate bite marks on my breasts to Hebrew tongue. We violate beehives, bathe in drones, lust, hot gloss, amber mire, harp strings between our torsos. We ingest David's murderous delight. Clean each other with our mouths and cry holy. Saliva is swathe, ghost lairs net broken skin, mummifying our condemnation. Chisel psalms keloid on bare backs, eroded by Rahab's caress. Flesh is granite, we mine stone for water, howl until Jericho's fractured walls heal, cough up crosses, kill our babies, puke manna to purge us. We hoard figs, sew leaves into sheets. I pollinate your scrotum. You trespass on my abdomen. Squeeze redemption into my stigma. Gap between us, my wound. We stitch our open bodies together. Branded unholy by orange-white tip of the Spirit's pig iron. Thank you. One more? Two more? Okay. she went like this, and I was like, I only have 10 minutes total, so I don't think I have 10 more. Sophisticated. My blemishes are the craggy cliffs of crowded mountains competing for room in the sky. Features disappear in this Sierra Nevada. I trace my body with red ink, peruse Vogue and Elle, literature that enlightens my self-hate. This is the classroom of my inadequacy, where a woman in wiry glasses with loose bun and V-neck argyle appraises me, diagrams my imperfections on chalkboards, dissects deficiencies with microscopes, pontificates with pointers from behind a podium, schools me on the nuances of my faults, subtleties only the erudite are privy to. My defects, Mondavi Pino, ever blossoming on my refined palate, sophisticated to a flaw. Thank you. I noticed the two poets before me both had I want poems. They started a lot of the stanzas with I want, and I have a similar poem, so I thought I'd read that as well. This is the first poem of mine that was published in Pearl. It's called Querer. I want to crucify the ocean on your cheeks, stretch your heat over fire and cook it, let it drip dry on clothes hangers, singe it with my hands. I want to lift the light of day on my shoulders, sweat and carry it to you as it sets in my hair, whips my back. I want to sip your pain, become deaf with your silence, cut your touches into wholeness, shave my head of your hair, mar my face with your beauty, gorge myself with your hunger, shoot feelings that fly too high like planes, lay them bare, touch their dead breasts. I want to sew your blood into white sheets, sleep in your sickness, lie my head on your kick and paint it crimson. I want to read your face like sheet music, sing it. To soak in your absence, squint at your essence, examine it fold by fold, strip it off, shatter you into glass, walk barefoot on your shards. I want to extract your honey, but have no tongue. I see my reflection in you as in a wall. You, my glow drawn with lead, the spit I use for pigment, the slap that is song. You gong, my stomach falls out. I ask you to throw away your arms. I dance you disembodied. I want to be unreachable and your bed. Turn you to me, turn myself into a violin or corner. Theater for you to dance in, galaxy to explore, to fuck our dreams until sex commits suicide. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Okay, I guess you've noticed it's not Amelie Frank anymore. It's me, Suzanne Lummis. We're beginning the next exciting chapter of the evening. And we've had some terrific poetry up here. I'm just stunned. The good news is it's not over yet. And I do want to thank my agent. Oh, no. That's a different show. I've just always wanted to stand in front of an audience and say that. I would like to thank, again, the Los Angeles Public Library Foundation and Louise Steinman. And I would like to thank Poets and Writers and Jamie. And I can't see him back there, but he's there. Terry McCarty. Yay! Terry McCarty, an actual individual. And he's not even Bill Gates or anything like, or Steve Forbes or anything, and yet he gives money. So I'm going to stick with the world stage theme that we have going. So Brian, are you ready to leap up pretty soon? Brian came to me as a student, first of all. The world stage, I think, sent him to me. He is so young. Oh my gosh, he's so young, and he writes such good poems, and he takes the bus. Also, another thing, he rides the bus. I mean, he's a phenomenal young man, and he's one of the most talented poets I've had in my class. And so Brian, I want to hear your new work, too. But you'll read something that you developed in my class, right? Too. Good. Just for my ego, for the sake of my ego, you know. All right, Brian Sanders.
I want to thank Suzanne and the world stage. See you guys over there. And my friends and family for being here and stuff. Since Suzanne already mentioned something I wrote in her class, I'm going to mention a poem she mentioned to me last time I saw her that I actually wrote in her class. It's called Concrete Eyes. Midnight is wax crying down a Virgin Mary candle blazing at the lip of a bloody curbside. Its stories stand in silence, like the tree that's left after a war between brothers. It uses the light of a shotgun blast on pavement that has forgotten the sun, breathes like a bullet into the back alley eyes of a woman who only knows this kind of darkness. She dances with midnight above her grave as it machetes through the silence in her bloodstream. Then she lies down on the sidewalk. Midnight cries her to sleep. This is a poem inspired by my youth. I actually wrote this poem in Suzanne's class as well. It's called Just Move. The boys wore khakis creased and cuffed at the bottom. They would sit three quarters off the behind. Chucks were the tailored shoe of choice. The supposed gangster folds the tongue, strangles it with fat laces. The wave cap strings hung out back pockets. Fitted hats never touched foreheads. The girls more so scientific, with belly rings, thongs, and push-up bra experiments. I wonder how they can move in those tight jeans, rainbow-colored Timberlands, airbrush tank tops whisper, "I know you want me." Surrounded by the Pacific breeze, so jackets were considered taboo. We met with secret handshakes, fist pounds, barely looking each other's eyes. who will dance first? Turn the music on. The windows shake, gunshots, fireworks go unheard. Mama already upstairs with a headache. We peel off the walls, palms get baptized in sweat, throats pull bricks up Mount Everest. In these situations, you don't talk, you just move. Mosaic sweat on faces engraved in puberty, rump shaking, doing its best to be grown. Sweat smells good. Bodies are God's hands molding pottery. I melt my fingertips into her hips. The curve of her back slowly recedes. My thumbs piano the dip in her spine. We become song. I wrote a lot of poems in Suzanne's class, man. Y'all, I'm just gonna keep that theme going. This next poem I wrote because I was dealing with another class, but I wrote it in her class. It was my anthropology class. It's called God's DNA. Sometimes I like to sit in my anthropology class, warp myself in the theory of evolution, and wonder what it would be like if God were a gene. I wonder if God is deoxyribonucleic acid, if he can shoot hormones and enzymes, and imagine if he can unzip my DNA like I unzip my girl's apple bottoms. Can God release neurotransmitters, create synapses, or become Thelonious' hands traveling down my spinal cord till it feels like April in Paris? I wonder what it would feel like if God's hands pushed my blood cells into empty spaces. How would I react if God controlled the nerves in my palms? Would things begin to feel different? I would walk on hands across the Arctic just to make sure. I wonder if God was the bacteria one finds in spit, if I would be happy when someone sneezes on me. Probably be demonic to take antibiotics. What if he copied my DNA until we both became monozygotic? If God were my twin, what would that make me? I'm sitting in my anthropology class. Darwin's portrait hangs on the wall. His eyes are pristine shininess. Monkeys surround the room, begin to taunt me as my teacher holds a clay replica of Neanderthal skull. He handles this skull as if he is carrying his dead mother's ashes, and a gust of wind will blow these ashes away. Okay, let me do a poem I didn't write in Suzanne's class. Let's see if you guys like it. I don't know. This one is another one from my youth, based on my youth. I used to play basketball all the time. It's been a depressing time these days. I don't even want to get into it. Anyway, this one's called Prisoners of War. Under the sun gods and Aztec warriors, running beneath the shadows of pyramids and solar eclipses, hands become unshackled, throw the ball into hollowed stone. Loser gets decapitated. Winner gets decapitated. Under the shadow of 20 tennis shoes hanging from telephone poles, a burned-down house, cracked concrete, oily driveways, broken glass, used condoms on the curb, potholes, murky water puddles, seven-year-olds play 3-on-3. Shoot the ball into an upside-down shopping cart, a black hole sucking on negativity's bone marrow. Under the foggy glares of eyes with no home, trapped inside chain-link fences, pavement speaking graffiti language black. Lips wrapped around glass pipes like the throat of a wailing baby, park lights turned off. The ball is music. Fingertips play concrete symphonies. Bodies become violins, piercing gravity's darkness with war cries over the baseline of dogs and bullets and empty stomachs. Tears of pain splash into chain hoops. Sanctuary, where calloused hands paint silhouettes of hope into moonlit sky. The drum beats of the hood still beat for prisoners of forgotten wars. The winner is the one who still dreams. I was in a musical mood like for 3 weeks, and I just kept writing. I just kept writing poems that were like, I'll read you two poems that had music going on. I read them the same day, but they're just totally different from each other. Okay, this first one is called iPodding It. Tupac is so loud the crackhead next to me is scratching to the beat. I don't even notice the stench that hasn't bathed in 2 months. Family portraits found within the DNA of Crips and Bloods. Thugs are celebrated warrior sculptures. A deuce deuce is a paintbrush. The revolution is California love. I'm getting damn near nostalgic in the city with gunshots that tore over my cradle. This was my nursery rhyme. It's 95 degrees outside. We're crawling inside the smoggy swamp. The bus is standing room only. Drones through the hood like a giant orange casket. My head nod resembles a zombie. It's turned into sweat on my shoulder blades. I think I see my childhood, but damn, the song's over. She was the cellist, he was the song. Her prayer traced the lining of the saliva on his tongue. Her empathy rested in his shadow. She carved honey into the strings. He sung silence into the well of her belly, sliced nectar into the endless echoes of swollen tears. His voice, the holy grotto of her graffiti jungle. But the green in his eye was her only spotlight. So she's gone. And he bleeds raspy harmonies into her chocolate silhouette, whiskey skid marks singed into his throat. His condolence is the concrete wilderness of a dark stage. The glare of his shrill pupils is his only spotlight. Okay, this poem is called This Is What She Feels Like. I've escaped the lakes and oceans only to find hushed serenity in thirsty basins covered in soft brown clay. I've shed skin and muscle, the mortality of sweat makes my bones ache. I drink silt, devour diamonds, dance on hot coals, worship within sandstorms. Sunlight crushed into my back. Molten lava crawls into my lungs. A spring of brimstone drenches my hunger. She cries tears of ash. I spread my arms and begin to scream at a sky that looks broken, and all the black of space is creeping into the blue. I see my eyes for the first time. Just me and the black. As we burn ourselves into shadows, the world submits to our endlessness. This dark solitude covered in the heat of our breath. I touch her. We are the napalm dropped into a valley of bones. I'm going to do two more. One more? One more? Okay, cool. Thank you. I wrote this poem in Suzanne's class as well. This came out of an assignment to look out a window and write, well, she said look out a car window and write what you see. But as you saw that she mentioned, I catch the bus. So I was looking out of a bus window. And to my surprise, I saw a burning trash can. And it was that moment that I kind of realized why I write. You know, I write because I want to educate younger children. And the reason being is it was younger kids that were burning this trash can, setting trash cans on fire across my neighborhood, actually, just getting out of school, and they're still in their school uniforms in broad daylight. This is called King Shaw's Parking Lot. The dealers are stealth like snipers, speaking shifty-eyed whispers, using their hands to communicate territory and hypnotize addicts. Uniform with bleached snow-white T-shirts, gold chain crucifixes, tattooed Bible scripture. The sun shines the word of God wrapped around arms like vines scaling statues chiseled in obsidian. Savior hangs at the center of a rib cage with broken limbs, cheeks sunk in so deeply they seem to swallow the gold his tiny body is wrapped in. Music pumps from 808 speakers like 20 rounds of a submachine shot at rebels across an empty field. Pulsates on Hardleys covered in comic book scenes painted in tropical flavors, hovering the concrete like a desert mirage. Stir it long enough and saliva begins to taste like Starburst candy. 12-year-old's eyelashes wilt under the blaze of marijuana at the tips of his lips. Smoke floats up into fried chicken popping in two-day-old Crisco grease mixed with fried rice drenched in MSG and the burning sage of panthers asking for donations. They cry black power while sage burns in tightly quenched fists that once held automatic weapons, stood guard at closed windows, peering through dark curtains. These snipers, these adolescent potheads, these sage panthers all look at me like an unknown face traveling through a village just attacked by camouflage demons and Goliath rocket launchers. Still, I pace myself. I smell discarded cans of winos who sit motionless, minds shattered like a broken bottle of fermented ale spilled across unforgiving pavement. Overhear plots of youth lacking direction, these middle school rebels clustering together, planning to light an empty trash can on fire. They convene on dusty blacktops, these vast fields of dirt, confined within these vertical barred institutions, line up at the commanding shrill of a bell, teachers armed with shiny whistles hanging from necks like purple hearts hang from drunks in wheelchairs. They call off names from lists while an army of pimply-faced preteens all dressed in blue pants, white shirts, two buttons, stand attention silently. In the internment camp for 8 hours a day, eating food that makes taste buds cringe in agony, the trash can begins to burn. I tattoo the wilted eyelashes of a 12-year-old pothead and the shattered vertebrae of a comatose wino across the soft parts of my back. Transplant Crisco grease and MSG into my bone marrow. Plant the burning trash can on my chest. Let it sink in my rib cage and grab it in my rib cage, and the roots grab my heart like a mother grabs her son as his blood stains merciless concrete. Encase my words in explosive spit. Aim it at the pimply-faced revolutionaries who convene on dusty blacktops, endless fields of dirt. My words detonate on their eardrums. They transform into poetic legions whose words explode like literary geysers, blasting into this air that we can no longer breathe. This river with an unquenchable thirst melts the barriers of vertical barred institutions, frees the refugees once stripped of their creativity, clears the sight of a 12-year-old with wilted eyelashes, remolds the bone structure of motionless winos spilled across the sidewalk, replaces automatic weapons with fists of burning sage, and it covers us like a blanket so when we sleep at night, we can hear the sound of a golden savior melting in a burning trash can.
Okay, well, the next exciting poet combines literary writing and performance. I think she began, Rachel, where are you? Is this right? You started out primarily as a performer, right? And she performed all over the world, where? Amsterdam, London, Shanghai, Constantinople, and then... that's right, and then she began to study poetry with me sometimes and other people, and then she began to write fiction, right? And you won a prize, didn't you? Did you get some money for it? Yay! Oh, okay, and she got some money for the prize, and she's just dynamic and full of life and vitality and super smart. Rachel Kahn.
Had you, I, been given but seconds in this unreal reality and the 10,000 things not made themselves known to me, you, Dayenu. Had the 10,000 things made themselves known to me, you, and your, my blood not thudded circuitously, stubbornly, Dayenu. Had your my blood thudded circuitously, stubbornly, and these atoms not stayed gathered into matter as me, you, Dayenu, had these atoms stayed gathered into matter as me, you, and you, I, not been born earthly entity, Dayenu, had you, I, been born earthly entity, and these lungs not breathed me, you, Dayenu, had these lungs breathed me, you, and you, I, not strengthened from struggling, Dayenu, had you, I, strengthened from struggling and the time-space web not caught me, you, Dayenu, had the time-space web caught me, you, and you, I, not made manifest, believed in possibility, Dayenu, had you, I, made manifest, believed in possibility and never felt faith inside me, you, Dayenu, had you, I, felt faith inside me, you, and not lost ego identity, Dayenu, had you, I, lost ego identity and not detached from a conceptually separate me, you, Dayenu, had you, I, detached from a conceptually separate me, you, and never found inner tranquility, Dayenu, had you, I, found inner tranquility and never let angel death tongue kiss me, you, Dayenu, had you, I, let angel death tongue kiss me, you, and not answered with reciprocity, Dayenu, had you, I, answered with reciprocity and not still vibrated energy for eternity, had you, I, been given but seconds in this unreal reality, had it all been arbitrary, had it all been but a word, a breath, a blink, a touch, a grace, a pulse, a truth, Dayenu, Dayenu, Dayenu.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be here and an honor to read with all of the poets who are here tonight and all of the older, newer poets who are here in the audience tonight. I'm very flattered to be here. And a little shout out to my performance poetry students from UCLA Extension. I see you out there. And then my classmates at Antioch. I'm so excited. We're in a residency right now, going to school like 12 hours a day, and they still came to see me. Isn't that cool? And to Terry McCarty, thank you so much. And Suzanne, of course, for having me. Because you're, you know, why I'm here and all. And I'm going to do a poem I wrote in a class I took with Suzanne. And in case you're wondering, I was the other person at the bonfire. In case you can figure that out. So this is from my class with Suzanne, which was quite an exciting thing to do. It's called Special. Now, I cannot tell you his name, not even what breed, but I can tell you he was huge and tan and curly-furred, can tell you how his dog-strong back felt under my miniature hand, and how autumn early evenings, my father and I ventured the three-quarter block to Pacheco Elementary School, where I would roll around the blacktop, resplendent in my standard-issue white with red and blue stripes roller skates, de rigueur for any five-year-old girl in 1978, and sometimes Curly Tan would be there with his owner, an old man in a navy blue Greek fisherman's cap. And Curly Tan, he was dog enough for me to grab onto his leash, let him drag me, gliding over hopscotch and four square demarcations like I couldn't be fenced in, like I was somebody special. Now, I cannot tell you what it felt like in a father heart to watch such an event unfolding, but I can tell you how he made his arms a cradle for my skate-heavy, clanking-ankled body, how he spirited me home, laid me on my bed and unlaced the skates, how my face bled, can tell you how my mother cleaned that burning. I fled the scene by falling asleep. Curly Tan had been pulling me. It was blissful until wheel kissed rock, until I face planted into asphalt, until he had his back to me, kept right on running, how I covered ground like that until synapses at long last snapped to attention, until brain sent word to hand, how holding on was not helping. Such echoes, strained beggings, across blacktop, my father's voice, let go. Thank you. And now, I wanted to end with this poem, but I'm going to do a memorized poem, and it just feels like you can't go backwards after you put the paper down. So this is my most newest poem, although the Diana one's pretty new, but this is the most newest one. Hey you, with the stern look, behind which you try to hide that fat little sterno can heart. You can't fool me. Your incendiary gelatinous mess of yesness glows right through you, quivery and pitter-pattering and fabulous thoracic iambic pentameter. I see you. Smile. You're perfect. Reality crumbles down around you and you're mad about it, sad and scared and wanting to go backwards, but you can't, grasping for every passing branch as the flood tumbles, digging in mud, fingers wrapped around roots, gripped, knuckling it. Honey, let it go. Lovely, let it come. Destruction has its hour. Imagine reality's hands strapped to your wrist like a watch. Right now, that holy Rolex knockoff would read right around 9 o'clock. But if reality were time, that's different. Then all would fall at around 4:59 a.m. Empire tumbling has its season. If the limitlessness of quantum eternal existence were confined to a calendar, it'd be winter. Let others grumble as the price of gas ascends towards heaven. Let it rise like a hallelujah chorus at a Baptist revival. Let the crime of neglect against the child mind finally be deemed unacceptable. Let the school system that failed you collapse in on itself. Let the expired empire crumble. Let the empty, obsolete edifice tumble. Loosen your grip, let the facade fall, because it's all coming down anyway. Let everyone hate you for being strange. Let the pain come when it does. And if the scream or howl or yelp or laugh wells up inside you, let loose. Let your sternum crack open like a wishbone. Set that jellyfish soul of yours free. Oh, does it hurt, and oh, does it terrify, but this earthling thing? It's the dance we're currently dancing. Why do we find ourselves, our fallible, slobbery, awkward human beingnesses in this particular predicament? In this time-space place where nothing stays the same and things always fall apart eventually? Why this here-now time wherein our angle of repose pushes us over irresistibly as we shove our own nose in our own shit, pointing our own finger at our own stains in the carpet? Oh, because it's wonderful here. Just the littlest blip on the radar of eternity. And even when we can accept that intellectually, it's the owning it in our wishbone souls part that gets us all edgy. We came to move forward through the wind as it whistles past us. We came to eat chocolate. We came to feel the sandpaper tongues of kittens on our wrists. We came to kiss. We came to listen to Otis Redding. We came to recognize. We came for the forgetting and the remembering and the forgetting. We came for the first and the last slice of pie. We came for the party and we came for the darkness. At 4:59 a.m. It's not that there's a price to be paid. It's our skewed viewing that's so expensive. Hey, you, with the cynicism and the disagreement, with the grievance, I believe it. It's just that I believe in you more. This universe yearns to birth itself eternally. The tree drops its apple and it slams to the earth, splits in half, its starburst of seeds reaching up like a hand to caress your Eevee cheek, serpentine you into taking a taste. Each seed bursting with tree, each tree teeming with apples, each apple rampant potential, each starburst, each limitless possibility, life spiraling Milky Way in all its infinite wisdom, vibrating and radiant and reliable in its sunrise, knowledge free-falling in wondrous glory, thunderbolts spilling with the fulfilling of destiny like rain, and round we go again. Thank you. And then I wanted to finish with an oldie but goodie love poem. And again, it's such an honor to be here and to read with all these extraordinary poets. So thank you. When I lie down beside you, your fingertips whisper to me secrets that you don't even know you know. Your touch belies your desire like live wire sparks fly when I lie down beside you, and Lord knows I am yours. Spread me open, unfold me like Ouija. Without speaking, I will convey supernatural communications like clandestine alphabet beating beneath my chest, like this way means yes. Like never having to second guess, like prophetic text made manifest, like rapture light crackles when I lie down beside you. Press against me, I am strong enough to receive the message you're delivering. Believe in the taste of my devotional. Notice the way I melt for you. Let every tear be dripping elixir. Let your sweet exhalations fill me. Let there be laying of your hands on my body. Memorize my topography. Listen to the whisper of my history. I am physical science when I lie down beside you. Play archaeologist to my landscape. There are verbs needing to be unearthed, truths traveling circuitous routes through my veins. I hold all of your answers rattling in my wrist, and revelation with bliss remixed in the glistening on my lips, and match disclosure chance for chance with the dancing in my hips. I can uncurl my defenses if you let me. Lay the manuscript of your meaning at your feet. Discern your direction with the cleft of intimate wish held out before me. I am your diviner when I lie down beside you. I am your trail of astral projected breadcrumbs, preternatural cartographer, spirit guide in the flesh. Unwind my DNA and view the blueprints of my destiny, and then rest with me, breathless but easy. Set your cares in the nautilus of my ear. There they will mingle with the whisper of eternal rolling ocean. I want to hear. I will hide them like buried treasure, and they will be there within, whether you ever retrieve them. Waves crash bright when I lie down beside you. You riptide into me. Let me love you hand to mouth, cheek to cheek, speak in tongues against my skin. You are delicious beyond recognition. I give into this precious potential like constellations weep in appreciation of our creation, like spheres wax harmonic, like everything spinning in unison, like we are more than our human machinations or molecular combinations. We are mystery constantly unriddling. I am particular night sky when I lie down beside you. So take me and make me your astrology. Plot your path by my best star. I offer it like open palm, like conviction, like undeniable truth, like specific blessing, like honest, like you inside me, like lightning striking twice every single time. So take me like I am meteorology. Take me like metaphysics. Take me like poetry. Take me like I am. I am. I am when I lie down beside you. Thank you very much.
What's really great about this series is you get to see such a cross-section of everything that's going on in contemporary poetry. So when you walk out of here, well, you'll know everything. You'll just know everything, everything there is to know. Our final poet for the evening is C.C. Perry, who has been taking the town by storm, all the way down to, I think, Redondo Beach, and all the way up to Woodland Hills. And, she is, I'm a little bit embarrassed all of a sudden that all of the three have studied with me, but that's just because sooner or later it seems everybody comes around and studies with me, I guess. So Cece, it came from New York originally. You're going to hear that little bit of New York, that wonderful New York sound. As she has humor, she has powerful poems. She's smart. She's funny. She's sad. She laughs. She cries, etc. You get the idea. Cece Perry. going down. Okay, here we go. I want to thank, of course, LA Poetry Festival and Beyond Baroque for hosting this. This is a wonderful venue and a very big honor. And I want to say that I'm so honored to be with these wonderful poets. I'm in awe of what I've heard. So, and of course, I want to thank Suzanne, whom I have studied with. When I came out from New York, I found Suzanne, and I have studied with her ever since. All the poems that I read tonight will be better because I studied with Suzanne. Okay, so let me just start with the bridal registry at Macy's. We work our way down the aisles, down the list, picked thin by the bride's family and friends. My daughter and I left with little else but serving spoons and ladles, the backbones of domesticity. A second glance at the list reveals an overlooked item, heated towel rack. I gather up my weary grandson as my daughter takes the item to the register to be removed from the list and wrapped. Later, she, who not so long ago was herself a bride who believed in warm towels, folds the list and lets it slip into the wastebasket. Soon, she says, they'll see. They won't need half those things. And there, in the bed and bath department, I want to put my arm around her, or at least run my hand over those errant strands of auburn hair. Instead, I shift the sleeping boy on my hip. Thank you. An introduction. It's Thanksgiving, a good time for my boyfriend to meet my mother, sister, brother, who greet him like another mouth to feed. Feed on. The festive table holds the fatted calf, a turkey, and goblets who cannot hold their wine. After dinner, my brother, who has eaten the meal in his undershirt, announces that he needs a dress shirt to go out. My sister bristles as my mother sets up the ironing board there in the dining room. I take my boyfriend to the living room where we talk until the voices in the other room become too dull and the movements too sharp. Wait here, I say, I will be back. In the dining room, my brother has backed my sister into the table. She reaches for the carving knife, which clatters to the floor. My mother has disappeared like the apple walnut dressing, and I raise a chair above my brother's head like a bouquet of balloons. My brother kicks the knife and sends it slicing, sluicing across the floor, leaving a plume of red in its wake. My mother reappears with the man from across the hall, who drives us to the hospital where I hold my brother's hand as the house doctor stitches up his foot. When we get back to the apartment, my boyfriend is still sitting deep in the cushions of the couch. I introduce him to the man from across the hall, who tells me, marry him. And I did marry him. And I want to thank him for being a good sport when he winds up in my poems. This next poem is about a marriage, not necessarily my marriage. Okay. Just married. Just married, sprayed in shaving cream on the back of a blue Volkswagen Bug. The couple inside is young, deliriously happy, and in love, like we were the day we drove away from the waves of well-wishes in that tinny, tiny Renault 10, headed who knew where and with the rest of our lives to find it.
Today, we are stalled in this lane of serious traffic behind the blue bug. We are not young, not delirious, not in love. We are just married. This next poem is a pantoum, which is a Malaysian form with repeating lines in a special order. Okay. The fortune teller said, I live to 100, a pantoum. The fortune teller said, I live to 100. From the spirit side, my mother protects me. I'll outlive my husband by quite a few years. He won't have to suffer. He'll die in his sleep. From the spirit side, my mother protects me. My husband, she said, was more like a son. He won't have to suffer. He'll die in his sleep. Under a double ring duvet, me lying beside him. My husband, she said, was more like a son. On Sundays, he drove her to church and to market. Under a double ring duvet, me lying beside him. He managed her savings, made sure she was solvent. On Sundays, he drove her to church and to market. He didn't just leave her, he stayed by her side. He managed her savings, made sure she was solvent. He still tends the roses we planted in memory. He didn't just leave her, he stayed by her side. In many ways, they made a cute couple. He still tends the roses we planted in memory, my hand on his shoulder, the last thing he'll feel. In many ways, they made a cute couple. I'll outlive my husband by quite a few years, my hand on his shoulder, the last thing he feels. The fortune teller said, I live to 100. Thank you. And the next poem is a noir poem that I worked on in Suzanne's noir class. This was inspired by a photo of a scene from The Sleeping City, which was a 1950s noir film. The scene took place in the automat. I didn't see the movie, I just wrote the poem from the picture, but I have eaten at the automat, so. The automat. She steps out of the rain into the automat, spigots a cup of coffee, puddles her way to the table with the stained glass window, kicks off her 4-inch heels and stuffs them with wads of paper napkin. Then, no sooner does she pull out her Anna Karenina than in strides Richard Conti, all business in a suit. Well, she thinks, tonight the mascara may not be wasted. His eyes pick over the glossy cherry tables, all empty, so he swaggers over to hers. I need a driver, he says. Know anyone? I know lots of people, she says, but maybe I'm what you need. His chin points to her open pages. You got something stronger than a library card? Sure, she says, I got what it takes to drive. What's the pay? Haven't figured that out yet. It sorta depends on you. She loops her red lacquered toes over the rung of the chair next to him and pushes. As he slides into the seat, she wonders, how does one go about getting a library card? How many? One? Two? Two. Okay, two. The next one is also noir. The fry cook. At the flat top grill, he was all business, flung raw eggs dead center into the corned beef hash like a strapping southpaw. In the alley around me, he was all ideas. Said he'd be leaving soon, had a shot back east, a tryout for the big leagues. Said his sister would loan him a Buick convertible, and he'd fill it with malt beer and tuna. all he needed was a woman to hold his cat while he drove. I like animals, I told him. Then I dropped my cigarette into the dusty clay, ground it out slow, felt the road under my foot.
Thank you.
Take a drink. One more. Okay, my next poem is a persona poem in which you inhabit the character of the poem. And this was written in a persona poem class with Suzanne. The problem I had was the person, or the character I chose for the persona poem was Medea. So I had to, in Suzanne's guidance, inhabit Medea's mind, which was the last place I wanted to go. And I tried many, you know, different drafts not to do that, but Suzanne's encouragement was relentless. And I finally managed to do that, to inhabit that character, and I finally did it. The part Suzanne loves most about that story is that I cried, literally cried when I did it. And but I'm not crying anymore because I like the poem. So, as a just a refresher on the Greek mythology, for those who may not remember, Medea was the princess sorceress who helped Jason steal the golden fleece from her father's kingdom. They fled to Corinth, where they lived as man and wife and had two children. When Jason betrayed her, Medea exacted the ultimate revenge by killing their two young sons. Okay, now I have to inhabit Medea. Give me a moment. Okay. Medea. Each night when the sun dies in a sky of shaded skin, when civil mothers call their children in, I stand on a parapet to call their spirits home. My voice, a desert. My mouth, a purse of bone. Thank you.
Yay. Would all six of the newer poets please stand up?
Yeah. Wow. Fantastic. Very good. This was a triumph. A triumph. Thank you, you guys. Now we have to clear out of the library.
Everybody out now. Shoo, shoo. Go. Shoo, shoo.
Leave.
Okay. Leave now.
But I... Listen, I believe that 2 years ago, you sang for the audience.
Not
and you sang them home. And there was a talent scout in the audience, remember? And then didn't you get an agent? Didn't you get a record deal out of that?
I got served a restraining order, Suzanne.
But they won't leave.
Let these people
sing.
Go home. Let my people go. Thank you. I'll sing next year, okay?
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.